Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. King, let's ride, King.
At the sprinkle that one in, huh? I feel you. Recording early on a Thursday morning, a little bit of a change of pace, but we have some fun stuff for you. We are going to give our initial thoughts on the All-Star teams. It is a mess right now. But before we do that, a quick news note announced earlier today. Al Horford and the Boston Celtics agreeing to a 2-year, $20 million extension that is going to bring him through his 39th birthday, I think is the tweet from Adrian Wojnarowski. Steve, how'd you feel about the value? How'd you feel about the deal?
I like it. Both sides. I mean, Al Horford's been on demon time over the last couple of years of this Boston run, and they're going to reward that and also keep him around because he can still play. And so, you know, they don't have to worry about him leaving. You kind of have a piece of your core locked in. If not, he can still kind of pass things off. So, yeah, two thumbs up for me.
I feel you. I'm kind of surprised that that ended up being the number. Like, I understand it's probably lower just because of where he is in his career, but he's still really good. And I feel like if he hit the market, like, I think he's still above the mid-level exception in terms of skill set. But that's pretty much the extension that he agreed to. So he must really love Boston and the way that he's being used. And you zoom out and look at how good Boston is. Like, that probably isn't a situation that I'd be willing to leave very quickly unless the money was egregious, and it doesn't seem to be that. So, hat tip to Al Horford, who has been playing well, again, bombing away from three. More drop than last year, not switching as much, but still doing his thing in space. And this is obviously very good value for Boston to keep a linchpin of their defense in tow.
To your point, just real briefly, I mean, 10 usually is the market if you're tall and good. And so I do think he gave him a little hometown deal to an extent. He probably could have gotten more on the market, but why? I like this team. I like Boston. Let's just ride this out. And it's two more years, guaranteed. So, you know, make it.
Guaranteed years are dead. I wish I could remember, because I follow some Celtic fans. I wish I could remember which person it was that was like, man, we got Al Horford back on a lower number than the PJ Tucker contract. I was like, you know what? You put it like that. It really adds to how good this deal is for Boston. But kudos to both sides. Steve, it's only December 1st. I'm sure our rosters will change within the next 5 days, much less before the official rosters are announced in February. But it's time to dig in, see what we're thinking. First month and a half of basketball, see who's playing well, awarding some folks. Let's start with the short list. The players that didn't make it but were in consideration for you. Who did you have on your list on the east side?
That's not how that works. That's not how the document works. That's not how this is framed. No, we are doing buildup. If you want these antics, what is your short list first? What kind of shenanigans are these? No, I'm not revealing who I left off.
Oh, you get to toss the show sheet over the top rope, but I don't. I see.
You created it. You can't create it and then toss it over the top rope. That's not how that works.
I have quicker access to it. No, all man, right.
Who are your stars? You treating this like you bought the Bird app.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. We're putting a line in the sand. Steve, who are your Eastern Conference starters right now? Two backcourt, three frontcourt.
Quickly, I had a tough time with this. Like we talked about it last pod about the standings being so tight. There are some really great individual basketball seasons being played right now. And like really loosely, the MVP conversation should be fun. It's going to be gross, but goodness gracious. Like there's no way to put together your top five people without leaving off a really great player. But we'll go straight to the All-Star games. And by the way, salute to Devin Booker. 51 points in three quarters is insane. You said Eastern Conference first, right?
Yes.
All right. So backcourt, I have Donovan Mitchell, and I still have James Harden.
Ooh.
I believe he's going to be coming back soon. It seems insane just to leave him off. Guy's playing really good. So, yeah, that's where I went. Front court is also where it got interesting. Mm-hmm. Last year was penciled in. KD, Giannis, Embiid, leave it alone. This is not the case this season. It's still penciled in. But to me, it's KD, Giannis, and Tatum. And I don't know how you argue it. I'm sorry, Joel Embiid, playing great, but no. Backcourt, I have Jaylen Brown and DeMar DeRozan.
Jaylen Brown and DeMar DeRozan. Okay, okay.
Front court, Joel Embiid.
Yes.
A man who I almost left off the list, despite believing he's in all everything this year, Pascal Siakam.
Okay.
And Kristaps Porzingis.
Ah, you got a wizard in there. The pump fake is complete.
And then my wild cards are Tyrese Halliburton and Bam Adebayo.
Okay, okay. Our teams aren't super different, but ha! James Harden as a starting guard.
Yeah.
He has been very good. He's came out the gates extremely hot.
Yeah, I know. I know he's going to be disqualified because of the games played thing that you do, but the guy was almost averaging it. Like, he was really good.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. To your point, like, I do have the games played minimum for me. I kind of set the bar at 13 games. Everyone's played between 21 and 22 games, so I went for 60%. So that just kind of chopped the list for me. So on that note, if I could go to my short list. So no Pascal for me, simply because of the games. He's very much going to be.
There's no way. You have been Brett the Hitman Hart with this Pascal agenda, and you left him off?
It's simply a casualty of him missing time. That's all it is. Very much clear. Like, my thoughts and tweets are out there. Pascal has been insane this season. And again, provided he stays healthy, like he's going to push for a starting spot on my team, provided he stays healthy. But as of now, not on the list. That's going to be, to your point, that's why I don't have James Harden in consideration for this one. Missed a ton of time. Not a note on how well he's played, just has not been out there enough. We will revisit this when we do a check-in, maybe a month or two later. So we'll go there. But anyway, my starting backcourt. I do have Donovan Mitchell as a starting guard. I also have Tyrese Halliburton as a starting guard, leading the NBA in assists, the Pacers' top four seed right now, bombing away from three, improved efficiency inside the arc. We are going to scrub what he did in that Kings game last night out of memory. It's not going to help the All-Star case, but he has been playing extremely high-level basketball.
I think he has, but he was hella hurting last night.
Hella hurting, indeed. You hate to see it. For the front court, I am with you. Jason Tatum, Kevin Durant, Giannis Antetokounmpo. I don't know how you argue those top three. Honestly, that's three of your top, seven on the fictional MVP ballot, if you had to put it out right now?
Yes.
Like, they have been insane. I am still in awe of Jason Tatum. We talked about Devin Booker. He had 51. Jason Tatum went 49 last night. He probably could have been 50 if he went 11 or 12 from the free throw line. So he makes the free throw line. I mean, if he makes the free throw, he has 50. But he's been insane on both ends of the floor. Kevin Durant also been insane on both ends of the floor. What he's been able to do as a weak side rim protector, in addition to the scoring. He hasn't even shooting that well from three yet, and he's still averaging 30. Relatively efficiently, he's just been insane for the mid-range. And then Giannis, like, cold spell a week or so ago aside, 31 points in 32 minutes is just not something you should be able to do on a consistent basis. And this is just who he's been the last 3 years. So that will conclude my starters for now. I had a really tough time with the reserves.
Oh, here we go.
There's so many good players in the East right now, man. And once... players start hitting the games. Play threshold, man. It's going to be a not fun time. But for the backcourt spots, I have DeJounte Murray and Jaylen Brown. In the front court, I have Joel Embiid, Kristaps Porzingis, and Bam Adebayo. And for my wild cards, I have DeMar DeRozan. And for now, I have Darius Garland.
Darius Garland, eh?
Darius Garland.
Good. No, he's been very good, so I understand.
Has been very good. 42% from three on nearly seven attempts, 23-8. The minutes with him on the court without Donovan Mitchell, I mean, it's been the same. It's weird in Cleveland that they're currently losing those minutes with Garland and Mitchell on the floor together, but both of them have just been dominant in the minutes without each other. That has held true. A little bit better for Garland at last check, but he's been very good. So mentioned Pascal. Again, that's solely games played. Mm-hmm. Who is your toughest cut?
I had Brooke Lopez up there on my first couple iterations. And I wouldn't call it. I could see him getting it over Porzingis. I could see him sliding into a front court spot, if we're being honest. Who did you have a problem kind of deciphering?
I was trying to figure out which Hawk I was going to have on the roster. Because I think what DeJounte has brought defensively to this team and what he's brought as a creator, like, he's obviously been very good. Trae Young has not shot well to start the season, but he is still the focal point for defensive game plans. He's still putting up like 27 and 10. And you look at some of the on-off splits for those of those two. Like, the Hawks are winning the minutes with both of those guys on the court. When either of them play separate, they're losing those minutes. DeJounte losing the minutes a little bit, not losing them by as much with the Trey plus bench lineups. So if you want a little bit of a decider there, it's just trying to parse through, like, how much better has the defense been versus the amount of attention that Trey draws offensively. And again, even with him shooting poorly, like, the numbers are still what the numbers are. But I did ultimately land on DeJounte.
Trey Young's going to be an all-star. So my list or not, he's going to make it somehow, even with not shooting well. It's 27-9. It's 27-9, almost 10. So he's probably going to make it. At least fans might vote him in. He'll probably be a wild card. So that probably is going to either tank the Bam or Porzingis case. But I did want to give him a shout. But yeah, it's going to be hard for Trey not to be an all-star. Was there anyone else?
Yeah, I do have a list. I also had Brooke Lopez as a guy in consideration for me. If there was going to be a Raptor on my team, again, Pascal missed only because of games played. If there was going to be a Raptor, like, the recent push from OG Anunoby would probably be enough to get him into consideration. Like, I think we've talked about this before. He has to, conservatively, he's top three in defensive player of the year. Averaging 18 a night, three-point shooting is bouncing back. The drives have been surprisingly good this year. It seems to be a little bit more refinement there. He's had to carry quite the two-way load in Pascal Siakam's absence, and the Raptors are still hovering around. And they haven't had Fred VanVleet for a lot of that stretch either. So I think there's, again, a fringe case to be made there. He made my short list, did not make the team.
But... If I speak.
Ah, go ahead.
Nope.
All right, fair enough. So OG and Brooke, I had a question for you, but you mentioned Brooke in your short list, so never mind on that front.
What about Kyrie, Jimmy Butler, Bradley Beal? Any of these names?
Oh, yeah. I had Jimmy Butler on the short list. Don't think he's played enough, but the Heat have been really good with him on the court this year. Jalen Brunson was a name that I was looking at, particularly with this late push from him. And you look record-wise, like, the Knicks are bunched up with a lot of these teams that have an all-star. So he's just been good. I'll give him the nod. Had another wizard on the short list, Kyle Kuzma. I did not have Bradley Beal on mine. We go further down the list, he probably does, but, like, Porzingis and Kyle Kuzma are the two names that popped for me first. Kuzma's, again, been very good on both ends of the floor. Towards the bottom here, but Miles Turner, just a guy to throw out there. He's been very good defensively, career year offensively. That concludes, again, Bradley Beal. You could throw him out there. Kyrie, mostly going to be games played for him, but I guess worth keeping an eye on as we push forward. I think that is all I had. Did you have anyone else on your list?
Yeah. It's going to be funny to see how this evolves the next time we check in on it, though.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Pascal's going to get disgusting. Yeah. Pascal's immediately going to toss this over the front row for me, off the top row for me. Like, one more game and, like, Darius Garland's just not on my team. That's just kind of tough. Let's move to the West. Who'd you have in your starting lineup?
Stephen Curry, Luka Doncic in the backcourt.
Okay.
Front court. Look, man.
Go ahead.
Doing this exercise and pretending like LeBron James is not going to be an all-star seems foolish.
But who are your all-stars?
LeBron, Jokic, and Anthony Davis.
Okay.
And then backcourt off the bench, I have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Devin Booker.
Okay.
Front court, I have Zion Williamson. I have Domantas Sabonis.
Okay.
And I have Lauri Markkanen.
All right.
And the wild cards are John Morant, De'Aaron Fox. The okay. West guards are going to be nasty.
West guards are absolutely going to be nasty.
Like, I had Ja and Fox down before I had the front card picked. And this is with Damian Lillard still existing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Remember that guy? Future Hall of Famer? Yeah, he might make the team. Oh, man. In this case, yeah, this. I found that my list of players that didn't make it was a little bit shorter on the west side than the east side, but I feel like that might just be games for me in making that kind of cutoff. But yeah, the starters I did not have much fun with. Had to play with the positional eligibility a little bit to get my ideal team. So backcourt for me, I have Stephen Curry and Devin Booker. Front court for me, I have Luka Doncic, Anthony Davis, and Nikola Jokic.
Wait a minute.
What's up?
How'd you do that?
We're not going to have the argument today.
How'd you do that, though?
Luka with forward eligibility gets me there.
He doesn't have forward eligibility, hey, though. Well, again,
we're not going to have the argument today.
Actually, I'm going to make a sub, though.
We're not going to make the argument today. Like, either way it works. If I'm not mistaken, I think Devin Booker also had guard and forward eligibility last season for the All-NBA team. So either way, if you want to put Steph and Luka as the guards and toggle Booker and use Booker as a forward, since him and Mikal Bridges are on the wing, like, either way, those three are making it. Like, I just could not.
No. Wait, hold on. I'm going to have you repeat yours. I'm putting Andrew Wiggins in instead of Larry. Sorry, Utah.
Ah. Andrew Wiggins has been very good.
He's been better, and he was an all-star last year, so.
No, I feel that. That's all right. But no, Steph, Devin Booker, Luka Doncic, Anthony Davis, Nikola Jokic as my starting all-star team in the West. For the reserves, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, because of course. Ja Morant, because of course. In the front court, I have Paul George, I have Zion Williamson, I have Lauri Markkanen, so I guess one of us will have a Lauri rep. My wild cards were De'Aaron Fox and Jeremy Grant.
Paul George, yes. Walk me through that.
Cold shooting start to begin the season, but the defense has been very good. The scoring has bounced back. The playmaking has been there, like, between the stars on the Clippers. Like, he has been more of a linchpin than the other guy. The Clippers have been an elite defense this year, and big portion of that has been what Paul George has been able to do. And so that's how I would walk through my case.
Gotcha.
As far as the short list, like, Domantas Sabonis was probably the toughest guy for me. Like, decide between him and De'Aaron, because De'Aaron ended up being a wild card for me. Well, I guess the three-man weave of Jeremy Grant, De'Aaron Fox, and Domantas Sabonis is where I was like, what do I do with this? One Laker made the all-star team for me, and I don't think LeBron has been better than AD this year. Naturally, when the voting opens up and stuff, like, LeBron's going to make the team. He's going to be a starter, so it's not going to matter. But just in terms of, but if I was building a team, like, I would not have LeBron right now. A ton of missed time. Well, the combination of the missed time, the shooting, and he just hasn't been good defensively to me this year. And so, like, that's why I wouldn't have him.
Hey, I'm just trying to prep you for when LeBron and Wiggins is on the All-Star team here in a couple months, man.
Well, I mean, yeah. Like, again, once it actually opens up, like, our teams are just going to be wildly different. But if I'm building out my 12 right now, that's where I go. So Bonus was tough. How much consideration did you give Brandon Ingram?
A lot. But I feel like that him, Anthony Edwards, are adjacent in a way.
How so?
I don't know how much wiggle room they have. Like, I have Ingram over Edwards, but then it becomes Brandon Ingram or Jeremy Grant, and then it becomes, okay, where do I put you? Like, which spot do you get?
I see.
And do we, like, is it going to be you or Zion? Like, is it going to be one Pelican? Is it going to be one King? I got stuck.
I see. They just seen you give the Kings two. You're very high on what the duo is doing to Sacramento.
Yeah, they probably won't get two eventually. But it's tough to argue with what they've both done and what the Kings have had success-wise. I mean, Fox is having a career year. Sabonis is a big part of it. Sabonis is tricky because he's the type of big that just slides into a front court slot.
Yeah,
when he's playing well. And it's hard to turn down what Fox is doing, although it is the West, so guard-wise.
It's getting nasty. And again, we zoom out like 2 months from now. What stops Dame from overtaking one of these guard spots if he plays well enough?
Nah, that's why I'm a little concerned De'Aaron Fox joins the Mike Conley All-Stars.
Where
it's like, that'd be unfortunate. Hey, you did great, man. But...
We really proud of you. We see you. However, comma. If I can ask, since you did make the late swap, why Andrew Wiggins over Lauri Markkanen? Like, what kind of tipped the scales for you?
He got better. I mean, I could have put in Wiggins over Sabonis. Wiggins should be in. I think he's gotten better. His shooting's improved. His defense has been very good. He's held together a lot of what Golden State's doing, which is in stark contrast to when it was like, wait, what is he doing? So, you know, I think it's tough to debate. It's tougher to debate it this year than last year. I think he's been very good.
Okay. And based on recent play, if you're trying to project for it, do you anticipate do you anticipate DeAndre Ayton making any sort of push?
He could. He definitely, I think the front court is wide open. In all honesty, it's going to come down to personal preference. Like, I think there are some spots that are just wide open to play. I think Anthony Davis is going to be in, but you've got some names that are going to come back that are going to make it interesting. I think there's a push for multiple players. So I wouldn't be surprised or mad at DeAndre Ayton getting a spot just because of his play and the Suns playing well and CP3 being out. Like, I don't think I'd be mad at a lot of folks being put in the front court spots for an all-star slot. Some good cases to be made.
Okay. You didn't have one on your team this go around, but when it's all said and done, do you anticipate the Wolves getting a singular all-star this season? Or is it just already cooked for you?
The oven's on. Cat was probably their best shot. Unfortunately, he's out. Thank goodness it's not worse than it looked. And Anthony Edwards is going to have a unbelievable offensive tear. Probably knock on the door in the West.
So more performances like the Grizzlies game from last night.
Yeah. He's going to play Dylan Brooks every night for that tour. But yeah, this is not the Rudy year.
Yeah. don't know about that one this year. He might wind up getting there though. Cause I think the offense has been wonky. Both ends of the floor have been wonky for Minnesota as a whole. So we'll see. But no, like, I don't think Rudy, he doesn't project to be one right now. What's up?
I thought you was going in a different direction.
Where did you think I was going to go?
I thought you had a plus minus or screen assist stat for me. I wasn't prepared. I was going to get some more coffee.
I mean, I think he's still leading the... Okay. Anyway,
all right.
I won't do it. But okay. Nice quick look into our minds there with the all-star teams. We will circle back at a later date and see how that updates. But let's move to a mailbag. Thank you to everyone that sent in mailbag questions. Again, if you have basketball thoughts that you want to get out, want to hear us talk about, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We will get to them. And we will start with this question from Teej. She asked, I asked this in the watch party, but asking again for a little more depth. I was listening to a broadcast and they were saying that players or coaches like to have their defense in front of their bench in the fourth quarter. When they said it, my thought process was defense leads to offense, so you'd want to be able to amp your team down the stretch. But per the broadcast, they said it was because they could give offensive instructions in transition. Did you have a preference when you were playing versus when you were coaching? And in your opinion, which would benefit the Raptors?
Well, love this question. Threw me for a great loop. Spent entirely too much time on it. Probably forgot to eat as much breakfast as I should have because of it, but we're here. So visiting, for those who don't know, visiting team gets to choose which basket they want for the first half. And side note, I've seen some petty things done when it comes to this. You know, so if you want your offense in front of you, your defense in front of you, different schools of thoughts that go with it, different approaches. Like some teams really like to have their defense in front of them in the second half so they can yell out instructions. They can set things up when it counts. They can make sure they're making adjustments or communicating. Some teams like to do that from the jump. So that way we can set our defensive tone to start and then we can make sure we execute down the stretch. Make the proper play calls, communicate, make adjustments on the fly. You know, there's value to having their offense in front of them more in the second half on the road. So that way we can communicate a little bit better than usual. And then, you know, every now and then I've seen it be opponent based where it's like, hey, well, if we don't score in the first half, it really won't matter. Or, hey, if we don't get stops in this first half, it just really won't matter. And then sometimes you get in a rhythm based on what other teams have chosen against you. And it's weird, but you just go with it. So, I mean, if you're the home team and everyone chooses one thing and it's like, hey, this kind of works, you might just do it on your next road trip. It's weird. That's a random one. It's far from me playing, never cared. Always wanted the defense in front of me in the second half if we were coaching. I blame Memphis for just ingraining that in my soul.
I was about to say, that sounds like a very Memphis thing.
Yeah, let's just lock up. And I mean, we're either humming or going to have to figure it out on the other end anyway. So let's just make sure we have everything we need on that end of the floor. I mean, plus, if you get a stop, we can just get a play call in the backcourt anyways. I think as time went on, I definitely saw the value of being able to have your offense in front of you in the second half. Just to be able to communicate little things, be able to get your calls off a little bit cleaner. Be able to tell guys where to go or maybe make sure they're in the right spots if a play breaks down. But at the end of the day in the season, you're going to get a good mix. Half your games on the road, half your games are home. Half the time you don't have a choice. So you kind of just got to go with it. Do what's best for your team. Now, here's what happened though.
Okay.
This question led me to an unofficial study, Nikias.
Okay.
And by unofficial study, that's a really fancy, misguided way to say I fell down a rabbit hole.
Ah.
So I started with last night's games, Wednesday, November 30th. There were 13 of them. So I looked to see what did teams want to do, right? There were 8 teams that went with having their offense in front of them in the first half and their defense in front of them in the second half. There were only 5 that went the other way. Those 5 teams that had their defense in front of them in the first half were the Washington Wizards, the Milwaukee Bucks, the Memphis Grizzlies, the Chicago Bulls, and the Los Angeles Clippers. Pretty interesting, right? So I fell deeper down the rabbit hole. Some people choose self-care. I choose rabbit holes. I clicked on every team's last road game to see what they did.
Okay.
And so what I got was 20 teams going ahead and having their offense in front of them in the first half and their defense in front of them in the second half. Only 10 that go the other way around. So I named 5. The other 5 are the Oklahoma City Thunder, the Phoenix Suns, the Los Angeles Lakers, the Utah Jazz, the New Orleans Pelicans. Now, again, unofficial study because I only clicked on every team's last home game or last road game. But there you go. Feels like offense in front of you and then the defense in the second half is like the default setting. And the other way is the advanced setting on your controller.
Folks, you are not getting defense in front of the bench analysis anywhere else. This is the official Dunker Spot promo. We will go tactics. We will go schemes. We will also go where, who do you want in front of your bench in the fourth quarter? We get in the weeds on this podcast. Steve, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for all of that.
Yep. Yep. So much time spent for that payoff. You love to see it.
That was beautiful. This is us. This is Sparta. Okay, let's move. Next question is Marco. We had a lot of post-up questions, which was interesting to me in his mailbag. But we start with Marco. We know Nikola Jokic is a pretty unique player in history, but don't you think some teams are, and more will be, using centers as their hub for the half-court offense, as the pivot the center used to be called decades ago? I think Domantas Sabonis is being used in a similar way. Do you see other examples? Maybe Bam Adebayo. Not sure about Vooch. Haven't seen much of Chicago. And in parentheses, it says equals nothing. Do you think more players with those skills will be given minutes instead of going for a more classic rim runner, sacrificing a bit of the rim protection front? Would it make sense?
Good question, Marco. And this is kind of a fun one. It kind of speaks to the evolution of the league overall. Bam and Vucevic do jump off the page. A couple other names that popped up to me, like Al Horford, Jonas Valanciunas, Mason Plumlee, Steven Adams this year in Memphis. The funny part, Robert Williams. Yeah, also as well. So the funny part is conceptually, teams have been going to that delay type action more and more to play through a big, to swing to a big at the top of the key, get some space and get some movement. They've been playing through them more. More teams are running handoffs. The set is kind of baked in more and more. So if you turn on a game, you're going to see some version of it. I think the difference for me when it comes to this question, this is where my brain went. Are you running the set or is this person's skill set part of your base? Like a Jokic is kind of an engine with that. Sabonis is kind of an engine with that. We can kind of build around what you can do out of the elbow or in transition or pushing it on your own. Not everyone has that same skill set. So the way I kind of related it was like, I started with like a cooking analogy, but it didn't really work out. So I kind of just settled into like, it's like kind of like a My Player in 2K or like some sort of video game with unlockables or badges. Like the more you have, the better it's going to work. But I do think whatever the player's skill set is and whatever the team's skill set is going to determine how much you're going to get out of this type of action. So Jokic is an unfair example to use, but he can pass, he can shoot, he can dribble, he can roll, he can pop, he can hand off. Wide variety of outcomes when you give him the ball. Sabonis can do a lot of those things. Maybe not a couple of them, but we can get the majority of this so we can kind of bake in action. Now you come flash to the elbow. Now we keep playing off you. That kind of enhances those two to a little bit. And they enhance the offense, kind of like a give and take. Do more players with those skills, are they going to be given more minutes? That's a tricky question, Nikaias. And forgive me if I skipped over Party Wars, Marcos, my bad. I probably would use your guy Hartenstein as an example of someone whose ability to do that handoff-wise, hub-wise, carved him out a little bit more of a niche or a role in the league than maybe he would have had before. I think his ability to do that and then being good enough at the other things enhanced his value. Now, I don't think that this is going to be viewed in the same way as like a pivot was, so to speak. I don't think it's going to be viewed like shooting or defense where you can just do this because it's a specialized role. But I definitely think it opens up more of a runway for bigs to have more of an opportunity or to pop in different places. Like, I think it's just going to be more of a compliment than, hey, this is what you do. That makes sense?
Yeah, I see where you're coming from.
Because it definitely depends on the environment, though. And I would also probably point to Hartenstein as an example. Looks a little different in New York than it did with the Clippers. He may not have changed, but the environment may have changed. The players he's playing with may have changed. The minutes may have changed. The rotation, you know what I mean? Those little things set-wise may have changed. So, I mean, you can have all the skill you want, but if the team is slow and you don't have cutters, then
what does it mean?
What does it do?
Yeah. And I think for Hartenstein, an example, like the personnel point is a good one because I think – part of what gave him more of a runway to do what he does, like it worked both ways. Like with the Clippers and that deep second unit, you had shooters, you had willing cutters. And so you can enhance the skill that Hartenstein has. And then whatever limitations that he had defensively, you just have a whole bunch of length and athleticism around him. And so if you have those kind of guys covering him defensively, like I don't think in a vacuum, he's like a bad defender on his own. Like I think he's fine. And then depending on what the scheme is, he could be better or worse. But when you are able to maximize what he can be because of the defenders around him, now you feel more comfortable playing him more. You get more out of the passing and how you can juice it. And also there was a need for him on that second unit because the Clippers, as talented and deep as they are, especially when healthy, like they didn't have a bunch of natural playmakers last season. So you could give him more of those reps. And so it just became a relationship network for both sides. It's a little bit different with the Knicks this year on both ends. And so, like, I do think that matters. So I guess just to bounce off of that, I do think moving forward, teams are going to be more willing to, I guess, give those type of players a chance because of the benefit that can have. And based on whatever other deficiencies you have with your second unit, like you have a big man that can pass and open things up, like that gives you a change of pace from your starting lineup, that gives you some ability to flow into half court when your star or your primary initiator is on the bench. So I think there's going to be a little bit more openness, but also the barrier for entry is still going to be there for those types of bigs. Because I think especially coming off the bench, you're still going to want to have some level of solid defensively, whether that's you in a drop or you being a switch big or whatever scheme works for you. Like that's still going to be prioritized more than I think the playmaking from the big spot. So like if that isn't there, like I still don't know how much it matters like wholesale. But I do think this is also just kind of a different branch of the league just generally going larger and wanting bigger playmakers. And I think that kind of fits into, again, a smaller part of it, because I think big wing is still the rage right now, even with Victor coming in. Like, you're still looking for who is the 6'8", 6'9", dude that can run the offense for us. But if you can also find a big and help invert your offense that way, like, that's just another side of that. So I definitely see like teams being more willing to go big in terms of creation.
No, and I like your point as far as what that kind of skill set does for a second unit, because that used to kind of be the role of, okay, we have a shooter. We can now run these movement sets because we have a shooter. Well, now we have a big, so now we can kind of use that as a reason to use, you know, some of this movement, some of these different sets. The one thing I do want to see though, some of these quote unquote strictly rim runners or rollers, I want them to understand that these type of plays and sets are also meant for them. Like when you watch, you can see the difference with players who are like really making reads or trying to make plays with a purpose, as opposed to those who are just like running the set. Like, okay, I'm supposed to catch it and dribble and he's supposed to get it. And it's like two dribbles in place, put the ball out. Okay, what have we accomplished here? Like, yes, the ball went from A to B to C, but we could have gotten more. Like, we left some food on the table. Like,
the defense still at A's.
Yeah. Like, you should be able to get a roll out of a dribble handoff. You should at least be able to be a pressure point. If there's more pace, there's more space, there's more tempo, and you as a big want to be more involved, this is an opportunity. But if you just take it as, well, they're going to get the ball back, it's kind of a wasted chance.
Bigs have to be better at the little things. Is this what I'm hearing? Because I am 100% with you on that.
It's a good shot. Go read Screen Time on basketballnews.com.
Oh, man. But no, like I just, like, yes, screening is important, but also even to the handoff point, like just running actions with a purpose matters, man. Like you may not get the ball over time, but like you hitting a guy on the handoff and rolling hard opens up the shot for someone else. Like ultimately, the team performs better when you do your job at full capacity in basketball. Just do that. Screen hard, roll hard, make contact on your handoffs. If you have to cut to clear out a side for something, like do that with some juice. You may get hit on the cut if someone gets caught ball watching. Like you just don't. That's becoming a pet peeve of mine too. Like you see guys running sets at half speed and it's just like, well, now it's 8 on the clock and now there's an ugly ISO. And so you didn't get the ball and the possession's ugly. So now everybody's unhappy. Like do your part and bank on your teammates to do their part and then you have something. If the defense is scrambled, you may end up with the ball anyway. Like just do your, oh man, not going to get in the soapbox. Let's go to, it's either Steven or Stefan. My apologies early on.
This is important though. You got to make sure you nail this.
Yeah, this is true. This is true.
What if it's Stefan?
If it's Stefan, then like, I'm opening up the apology early on. This I know how I feel about my name, so I don't try to do that to people.
Personally. Come on, Nokia.
See, this is what I mean. Before the season started, I had a vague idea about the Thunder using Josh Giddey in the post to get him some easier looks close to the basket, while also minimizing some of the issues with his handle. It hasn't ended up being a thing, but seeing Luka leaning heavily into post-up this season had me thinking, are post-ups underutilized for oversized guards?
It's a good question. I guess it depends on what your definition of a post-up is and what your definition of a guard is. Because I feel like everyone has a little bit different of a thing. And a lot of times post-ups will start in one area near the block and end up right by the three-point line with the face-up. So what are we determining is what? Like, is it just the pure bat down? Is it where you catch it? And then is it your determination on the court? Is it the matchup? There's a lot of things that go into it. I think it's, as the league evolves, a whole lot of the matchup hunting does go to the ability for someone to get an ISO or a post up. And we do have some players like Luka, like a DeRozan, like a Booker, like a Tatum, Jimmy Butler, who will go ahead and look to either attack matchups or put teams in position where, hey, this is the person you don't want to guard. So I think it's definitely still a showcase, if that makes sense. But on the flip side, we do still have the Jalen Brunson post-ups. We have Drew Holiday post-ups. We have Marcus Smart post-ups. So which category do they fall in? And how much of those are meant for them to score and how much of those are meant for them to try and keep defenses honest or get some movement off of it? You know, we watched Boston, Miami last night. They threw it to Marcus Smart in the post and they got something great out of it because Horford went up, set a flare for Tatum. Now they're off to the races. So which is which, I guess. What counts in this category? As far as Luka goes, I have always felt that his post-ups are more of a add-on or a counter than anything else. Like, you know, pick and roll, pick and roll, pick and roll, pick and roll. Okay, let's do this as well. Let's add this to what you guys have to worry about with Luka. What are you guys going to do with this post-up? Are you going to help? Is this a way for us to get a pure one-on-one opportunity? Does this get him closer to the basket? Does it take less energy for him to get some looks or get to the foul line? Can we flip that and now keep matchup hunting? So now y'all really think about this. How do y'all react? When it comes to Giddy in this example, my only issue is probably what would it do to your offense? How often would you go to it? And would you do it enough to where it makes the defense think or blink? You know, like are you running flex to get him in the post and get him a touch? Is he just backing someone down depending on the matchup? Like what does it do overall? Are you doing a post-up so now you can come down and now the big sets pick and roll and you get a short roll and him in a closer area? Like I just, the overall deal probably would be more to me than anything else.
I guess to underutilize, it's probably a boring answer, but I do think it depends on like who you're talking about. Like I do get the general theory of like, okay, let's let Josh Giddy post up. So you don't have to worry about the shaky handle in tight spaces or the burst. I get that functionally, but ultimately, like that's going to depend on like going off of your flex example. That's going to put a lot of onus on this screener to make sure that he sticks whoever Josh Giddey's defender is to get him to catch down low, and then to bounce off of something that you've been saying for a while: entry passing is a myth. Okay, who is passing to Josh Giddey? Because depending on what the lineup is, he's either the best passer on the floor or he is easily the best passer on the floor. And so you have to rely on that execution down low. And then also, okay, who's feeding him? Can you get him the ball on target? Can you get it to him on time in a timely fashion? Because if not, you know, again, Josh Giddey has gotten stronger. You see that on some of the drives he's had this year. He's still not the strongest of dude. So if that isn't, even if the screen hits to get him free down low, if that defender recovers, then pushes out his catch and he's catching it 17 feet from the basket, what did you accomplish? And depending on how long it took for that to set up to begin with, now you're later in the clock and you have to go to option two with Josh Giddey in an unfavorable spot or a less than ideal spot for him. He has less of a runaway. Like, I think it's an interesting dynamic with Giddey in particular, because he does have the issue of getting all the way downhill. But if you run out like a super high pick and roll with him, like that gives him more of a runway to figure stuff out. I don't know how I feel about the super low pick and rolls with him yet, because he's still trying to get that floater down, trying to get that push shot down. So like even the theory of it, it just needs some work. So I guess we'll see on that front. But zooming out just as a general note, like, sure, I think there's more utility. Like you mentioned, some of the guards that are getting post touches just to run into like post split action inverted that way. And so, like, I think there's value in it. And if you have a guard that has a size matchup, like, I don't know. Like, I think about it. Are the Wizards ever going to run, like, a post split with DeLon Wright, 6'6 guard? He's an over, you know, he's a big guard. Do you run that with him? Like, I don't know. Like, it's a genuine question. Like, what do you get out of Like, is that worth exploring? Like, it may be.
Maybe. Get some movement, but again, do you want the scoring? Like, how many times do you really want to go to that, the scoring piece of that, I guess, would be my question.
Yeah. And again, this is with DeLon Wright getting back, obviously, but just in general, like, is that something worth exploring? Like, Spencer Dinwiddie is a guy that can shoot over the top of you whenever he wants. Like, do you want to sprinkle in some post-ups for him when Duke is off the floor? Like, with just Dinwiddie's skill set, sure. And if you're able to get enough movement, sure. But has Dallas been the most movement-heavy team this year? Like, not really. Like, what does that look like with the second unit? Or if you're running that while him and Luka on the floor together, what can you conjure up beyond that? Does it just turn into an ISO? And if you're doing that, why not just run it for Luka at that point? So I think there's room for it. I don't think we're close to any sort of like revolution on their front. Not that that's the question, but just a note. I don't know if there's a big shift coming on that front yet. This question is going to come from Winston. Been thinking a lot about the Clippers closing five and if going small should really be their bread and butter. Zubac has been a top three guy for them this season, and while he might cap the ceiling offensively, his rebounding and rim protection feels necessary against teams like the Suns, Nuggets, and Grizzlies. Tyronn Lue seems to always win these staring contests with coaches when it comes to playing small, and I feel like teams will not try to beat Clippers at their own game in the playoffs. At this point, I'd try Norm, Morris, and Zoo next to the stars, but it gets into a different philosophical question about riding the hot hand versus knowing your best five. Because Terrence Mann, Nicholas Batum, Robert Covington, Luke Kennard, John Wall, and Reggie Jackson could all be in that lineup instead. Would love to hear your thoughts on the Clippers lineups as a whole or the concept of best five in the first place.
All right, great question from you, Winnie. Excellent reading, Nikias.
Sheesh.
The Clippers have me in hell, analysis-wise, just as an overall point. Apologies, but they really do. It's just annoying to try and understand and explain. Because the eye test and the numbers sometimes agree, and then they will just not agree. And that might happen in the same game or half or quarter or sequence. It's just excellent defense that sometimes looks like terrible defense, and then it's slow offense that gets even slower, and it's like, what are they doing? The defense is really, really good, and then it gets to excellent. It stays that way, and they get out and run, and then they get some transition buckets, and then they bucket get their way into a dogfight, and now you've lost.
Well, how do we end up here?
And then, hey, guess what? We still have Kawhi and Paul George, so we could be even better, but then we might just be the same thing. So leave me alone.
The Los Angeles Clippers, leave me alone.
Yeah, that's the tagline.
Wonderful tagline. Yeah.
No, I think in an ideal world, you'd probably love to be able to close with Zubac. I do think it probably lets them run more sets offensively. It does give them more of a base and more size on the other end. We've talked about this a lot, I feel like, during this season or the build-up to the season, how Ty Lue is going to try and be able to find the matchups, the lineups, the challenges of shaping the rotation. Honestly, at this point, I don't know if it's by default because of injuries, just because evolution of matchups, just trying to survive the season. I think this is going to be a running back by committee hot hand approach. I just really do. Like, this is working. We found this. Let's roll with this. I don't think that's going to mean he doesn't have an idea of what he wants to get to. But I do think eventually he's going to be like, okay, this is not working. We will also go to this. It's hard to explain that sometimes because you don't necessarily want to be searching all the time. But I think he has a knowledge of the team and the lineups that can provide certain things.
Yeah.
In certain moments, he can go to them. So it's a really delicate balance. Because in an ideal world, you'd love to always know your best five. But it is nice to have options to be able to build around that or build to that. Or in case maybe that specific five doesn't work in that specific matchup. The weird part is the only person I'd probably lock in next to the stars is Marcus Morris. Everything else is up in the air. Like every one of those names that were mentioned, they contribute something. And I alternate between, are these people in each other's way or do they each present this unique dynamic that helps the Clippers form like the fist of doom or something? Like, is this like a, what was my man in Power Rangers? What was the robot's name?
Oh, God. I'm blanking too.
That's all right. Somebody tell me dunkers. But it's like, are they all going to form together to build this up?
Yeah.
Is that what they are? So I think the concept for me is just keeping these guys in their best positions, understanding which combinations work and don't work, and knowing which players can give you what. Because it was, we literally had the conversation, hey, is Robert Covington out of the rotation? No. He factored into the comeback against the Blazers.
As did Musa Diabate.
Yeah. He got his energy. We might need Batum to turn the water off real quick, make a couple shots. We might need Terrence Mann to get in the paint. John Wall has the turbo button available today. Let's throw him out there. Oh, Reggie has 20 points. Let's continue to roll him. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like this weird give and take. And then, oh, we got this version of Norman Powell. Okay, he's in tonight. It would drive me crazy, to be honest with you, to have that many options at your disposal. But I think that's going to have to be the way that the Clippers figure this out. And it's just going to be a work in progress all year. That's going to be one of those rough drafts that have seven different names when you save it.
Yeah. Wow. What a shot. That's amazing. I think just to bounce off that, like maybe collectively we should move from best five to most optimized five, which isn't the most fun thing to say. But like, I think that gives you the leeway to do the kind of experimentation that I think the Clippers are going to have to lean into. It's just kind of saying, okay, what do we need tonight? What do we need tonight and who has it going? And then based on those two things, okay, this is how we're going to build the best rest of the boat out. We're playing Phoenix tonight. They have DeAndre Ayton. Also, they run a bunch of movement sets. We need the right mix of rim protection and rebounding so we can end possessions, but also we need switchable dudes up front in front of Zubac so we can cut out all the movement stuff that Phoenix is doing. Or if it's Denver and it's going to be a lot of Jokic, you're going to need size out there, but okay, screen navigation is going to matter a little bit more now. Let's make sure we have our best screen navigators out there. And to the Clippers' credit, like they have a bunch of options and an ability to toggle through all kinds of lineups. And so, like, I don't know if they're going to find a five that they're just going to close with 95% of the time. Between injuries and just the amount of depth that they have, I don't think they get there. I think Ty Lue would love to get close. I just don't know. I don't know how realistic that is. They have too many pieces. And so, like, I think it's just kind of optimizing on a game-by-game basis. Like, I really think that's what they're going to end up leaning into. They may whittle it down from 13 to 10 once the playoffs come, but those spot guys, I think it's just going to be a stay ready so you don't have to get ready type situation for LA.
It's such a weird balance to handle.
Yeah.
But I think the longer the season goes, especially if the roster keeps going up and down, in a sense, he's going to have more of a knowledge base where it can be more of a stay ready, get ready scenario as opposed to, wait, what do we have?
Yeah.
Which I think is probably the most important hurdle for him to clear, which I think he's done to a degree, at least to a degree that I feel more comfortable with it. But yeah, back to my Power Rangers point. Maybe they are just the Power Rangers. Because they had Megazord, they had Mega Dragonzord, they had Thunder Megazord, they had Mega Tigerzord, they had Ninja Megazord. Maybe that's the Clippers.
I love that you did research. It's like, oh, I know how I'm going to cap this question.
Rabbit hole season.
It is. We have the title of the podcast now, don't we? Let's move to the next question. This is going to come from James. As a Nuggets fan, I am unabashedly happy seeing Bobo wild out in Orlando. But I've also seen lots of takes that the Nuggets overlooked him and wasted him as a prospect. And Michael Malone is bad at developing raw talent. Do you think they did? Is there a way he could have fit and been productive on the current Nuggets squad? I should have started with, he has two questions, but that's the first one.
That's all right. Well, James, good for you to be unabashedly happy. That's usually rare. Most teams' fan bases are not that happy unless they're on the other conference. It's weird. Like, I felt like Jazz fans were like, yeah, good job, Royce O'Neal and George Niang. I tried to poke that bear last year. It didn't work. Anyways, I just don't know if I love the Coach Michael Malone is bad at developing raw talent deal. Like, does it take him a little bit longer to trust some folks than some may like? I can get with that. Does that mean he just can't do it? I can't go that far. Like, for me, I point to Bones. I point to Michael Porter Jr. And I look at that as growth for him as well. Like their growth is also growth for him as a coach. Understanding, okay, I need to evolve a little bit. I need to give a little bit more rope than maybe I usually did or I usually would. And sometimes you get put in those scenarios, either roster-wise, injury-wise, health-wise, where it's like, okay, I can't do that anymore. So I don't know if they get the same opportunity without some of those scenarios made available. But once they did, he saw it and ran with it. And I feel like that needs to be credited a little bit. As far as Bol Bol and Denver, fit and opportunity, again, are one of the biggest keys to success. Do I think Bol Bol could have been productive for Denver? Yes. Do I think we ever see this version of Bol Bol on the Denver Nuggets? Probably not. But there's only so much opportunity. The engine is different. Nikola Jokic exists. So it would have limited some of the chances, some of the margin for error, some of the opportunity. He would have been asked to do different things. I think that's one of the things that has to be calculated into player evaluation. Just because they do certain things doesn't mean that's all they can do. That may just be all they're asked to do. It's fair sometimes to be like, hey, why didn't the coach know that they could do this? You saw Bruce Brown saying, why did the GMs not think I could be a guard? Or you see Royce O'Neal in Brooklyn putting his fist up running pick and rolls. You know, and I'm sure there are times where it's like, okay, maybe we could have given him a little bit more rope, but we also have these guys. So we have Donovan Mitchell and Mike Conley. So Royce, you just beat guys off the dribble. You know what I mean? That's why different people look different in different places, because it's different ecosystems. Let's throw an example to you, Nikias.
Okay.
I hope this doesn't trigger you, by the way. That's not the point.
Well, this is a tremendous start. Okay.
But you're an excellent writer.
Thank you.
Let's say you get traded or signed to a squad and they're like, you know what, Nikias, we just need you 300 words twice a week.
God.
Could it work? Sure. Could it be good? Sure. Would it be the best version of you? Probably not.
Absolutely not. No.
Would we know that will we know what the best version of you is?
No.
Probably not. So, you know, it's kind of a deal.
I feel that. I was just doing some quick research while you were going there. The Denver Nuggets have not finished in the top 10 in zone positions defensively under Coach Michael Malone. That's just not what he does. And then just to distill a little bit more, Coach Michael Malone is very much about trust. He's very much about defense and doing smart things with the basketball. I don't know what kind of runway people expected Bol Bol to have in Denver, considering those things. That doesn't make Coach Michael Malone bad or anything of the sort, but like, this is who he is. This is why he has worked at his other stops and why he's been wildly successful in Denver since he's been there. Like, he's rigid in that way. And so when you have Bol Bol, who, again, much as I love him and as much as he has improved overall, like, he's still a mess defensively in space. It requires zone and a lot of it to really optimize what he could be as a shot blocker, keeping him near the rim. Like, from a scheme and style perspective, that's not what Coach Michael Malone does. So, like, that was already going to be against him. And then what's made Bol so fun in Orlando is that he has the freedom to grab a defensive rebound, push, go into a pull-up, go into this wild finish at the rim. Or if the ball swings to him at 12 on the clock, he can ISO and get buckets. That is not what Coach Michael Malone wants to do offensively. And for every wild highlight that we see from Bol Bol, and like I say to someone that's not just watching Bol highlights, watching Magic games, you can call me a sicko if you want, but for every highlight like that, we do have some very blatant missed passing reads from Bol Bol. Like, Bol Bol is ranked very highly in true shooting percentage this year. Like, he's not shooting 100% from the field. So some of these exploits are leading to bad offensive possessions too. And for a coach like Michael Malone, that's not who he is and that's not what he wants. And then you zoom out with Denver as a whole. Like, this is a team that wants to compete. They have a top five player. I don't think that was just going to work. So, like, you can quibble about how rigid he should have been in terms of Bol Bol's development. But ultimately, like, it's not a surprise. Like, I don't really like holding that against him. I don't think people should hold that against him. And this is on top of, like, Bol came in as a health risk. Like, there was no guarantee that even if he got the runway, he would have stayed on the court. Like, he landed in Orlando because of this. He was traded to Orlando while he was ruled out for the year. So, like, it's, I don't know if that's a fair thing to hold against him. But as far as could he have fit? Like, yeah, if he'd been a little bit like, okay, we're willing to go zone and give him a little bit of a runway, like, sure, it can work. But I don't know. I just don't, hindsight helps. But, like, I just don't like the Denver fit. Like, I don't know how much the runway would have been. Again, who Coach Michael Malone is, like, I don't know how much of a runway it would have been. Defensive limitations for Bol Bol, like, they just didn't fit. And one of the things that I do harp on with Bol Bol is, okay, what are these screens? What are these handoffs? And you know what Denver wants to run offensively in terms of the movement. Like, I don't think that was set up for either party to look good.
No, and you bring up a good point as far as when it comes to a team structure or what a coach is looking for from a player, because you may have an elite thing or a potential to do a thing, but you need to be able to do it. And if I'm going to give you that rope, I need to know that you're pretty good at it and I can count on that. So if as you come in and you're the offensive player off the bench and it's a little bit wild at times, that's cool. But now if you're just being wild for no reason and we're put in a bad spot, I can't afford that. So I got to go somewhere else. I can't afford that here. That's too much for me. Some teams can afford more. They can give you more wiggle room. You got more of a rope. You look different in different places. You know, some teams, your mistakes will be louder than in other places. That defensive breakdown that you could probably get away with in Orlando, that's going to hurt us. Because we need to win these, we need to compete in these 3 or 4 minutes when Nikola Jokic is on the bench, and now we're not. So now yeah. What do I do? Or hey, you know, we need to execute and get the most out of these possessions. We finally got some stops, but now you just took a fadeaway jump shot with 20 seconds left on the clock. Now they're running in transition and going on a run. I can't afford that. Maybe you can, but that's too steep for me. I'm gonna stick with my regular apple juice. Okay.
Wow. No Martinelli's, huh?
Nah.
Okay. Oh goodness. Yeah. Again, like from a skill perspective, like sure. And you look at what Denver has gotten out of their bigs off the bench this year. Like I think it's fair to say, like Bol has been better than their bench bigs this year. But like just how it fits into what the Nuggets want to accomplish on both ends, like I just don't know if that would have been the same thing. As for the second question, I think Malone's top five defensive goal might already be lost, but how can they become respectable on defense? Point of attack looks better with KCP and Bruce Brown, but can this roster change something to defend better in the paint?
It's just going to be on them. To me, I think they've got to do a better job of keeping dribble penetration in front. So a lot of times we go straight to the scheme with Denver. We probably lock in on Jokic, but they have to be able to keep the ball in front. They have to be able to defend the plays outside of the play, defend the quick pace and everything to where, okay, we're not getting beat off the bounce. We're not putting ourselves in rotation in times that we're not anticipating it. I think they got to dictate a little bit more defensively. I think sometimes teams are just too comfortable. You can see it where the pressure really isn't there. Bodies are, but the pressure isn't there. Offense is leading the dance. So while, you know, it looks like we're in a good spot, they're pretty comfortable as well. So now it's 50-50. So I guess it would be, what are you taking off the table as a defense? Or are you just existing within the universe? You know, can you be more solid? Can you move to more of a bend, don't break? It's kind of like they'll be locked in for 4 or 5 possessions and then they're scrambling out of nowhere. And then they have maybe a scheme issue. And so it's kind of a weird mix. So I'd probably say just clean up some of the low things, keep the ball in front, and you'll be better off.
Yeah, I think one thing we kind of brought up on the episode that we did with Zach Lowe recently, like the gambit of having Jokic on a non-shooting wing or someone that isn't like a handoff or a screening threat, kind of what Boston did with Robert Williams, like doing that to kind of simplify things. But other than that, I'm with you. Like, I think it's just going to be execution. Like, if there's a trade to be made to bolster the wing depth or to bolster the big man room behind Jokic so you can have better defense when he's off the floor, then sure. But like wholesale, like this is kind of the personnel. Like you know what Jokic's limitations are. Like have him at the level or higher, good. If he's in a drop or if he's switching, not so good. And so just kind of building the boat around what those strengths and limitations are, I think it's just going to be execution. To your point, like having KCP and Bruce Brown as screen navigators, that's a good thing. MPJ is at least working harder defensively. Like you're seeing more stints of him being in the right spot and being peeled in early enough and help and then making rotations from there. You just kind of have to bank on the growth and consistency with the guys that you have. Next question is going to come from Anthony. Two questions on Jonathan Kuminga. What do you think the optimal use of Jonathan Kuminga is? We've been seeing more of Kuminga minutes lately. Hat tip to you, Steve. And he's been allowed to do more with the ball, exploring his handle and having the green light as a three-point shooter. Do you think that this approach of giving him this increased offensive freedom is the best route for his development?
I think he's coming right along, as he should. I think it's difficult to go with strictly optimal use for Jonathan Kuminga. And I think that's more because he's with the Warriors and it's just a different ecosystem. For him, it's about being comfortable and knowing and understanding his spots with what they're trying to do. Developing that shot to make defenses pay, knowing when to drive a closeout to attack, knowing when to drive to draw help and kick, making quick decisions with that, you know, maintaining that aggressive mindset, but kind of containing it a little bit, if that makes sense, to where it's not just turbo button, oh no, what happened? I think the freedom to be himself within what they do is the most valuable thing for him right now. And then that probably be my biggest point.
Okay. Like, I think you have to, beyond the defense, because I think the defense is what's going to get him in the dance with this Warriors team. I think you have to let him explore with the ball in his hands. Like, I think in general, you need as much rim pressure without Steph on the floor as you can get. And between him and Jordan Poole, if they're in the second unit together, like, I think that's a... That's a solid base to have if you trust Kuminga with those reps. So I appreciate Steve Kerr giving him that room because, you know, as dire as it got with the bench as early as a week ago, like I do think if you're not trading him, you have to find something for the young guys. You have to find roles that they can be optimized in. And you have to give them a little bit of rope to explore who they are and what they can be for you. And so if Jonathan Kuminga's earned this, like, let him go. Like, I think go with that. I do think it helps with his development because if you're just asking him to do the cut and screen thing, like, he can do that. But if that's all he's bringing you and you can't add another dynamic, particularly when your stars are on the court, like, how much is that helping you long term? If you're not looking to trade him, like there has to be some staying power that you're banking on. And so obviously it's a good thing if he can fit in the system and if you can play him alongside Draymond and Steph and he can find his openings there. But you have to see, okay, if those guys aren't on the floor as, you know, Steph is an alien, but as Steph becomes like a top eight player like 6 years from now, apparently, because he's just never going to decline, can we trust you to do more? Because if the creation burden is only on Jordan Poole with their second unit, like that's a he's good, but like that's a boom or bust that I wouldn't be super comfortable with if you're looking at how do we stay at contender level moving forward. So yeah, like I think this is good for Jonathan Kuminga. Second question, additionally, do you think leaning into letting Kuminga handle and create more offense would help the Warriors bench unit at all this year, particularly in the long run? In theory, it would give Golden State more rim pressure, another guy who can create advantages and let Jordan Poole play off ball more. Well, I guess that answers the second part of the question. Steve, your thoughts on the long-term viability of Kuminga with the ball in his hand?
I mean, I just think the more of a threat he is to make plays, whether it's hitting shots or getting paint touches, the better off that unit will be. I mean, the Warriors are just so different since even if you start on the ball, the goal is to get off to the races and get the defense in a scramble mode. So how much value does that really have? You know, I don't know if he's ever going to reach the go ahead and cook level in that ecosystem because how many people really get that? But because of the pace and the tempo and the way they play, there are opportunities to be aggressive. So I just think it's more just developing into a threat, having multiple things you can do, and just letting your game come to you and knowing the spots, when to attack, when not to.
All right, there we go. And just to insert some quick news that just popped up to the phone. Yesterday, I think it was Shams Charania that said that Chris Middleton may make his season debut as early as Friday. Just got a tweet literally 30 seconds ago from Adrian Wojnarowski that Chris Middleton does intend to make his season debut on Friday against the Los Angeles Lakers.
Go to basketballnews.com and see if Nekias is really happy about Chris Middleton coming back, or if Giannis is, or if Jrue Holiday is.
You know, you may be able to find the answer there. This is going to come from Daniel. Shout out to hashtag Locked On Steve. That is a watch party exclusive. You got to get in there to get that one. Hope you are both doing well. I have a question for you too, as there has been an ongoing discussion with regards to the Lakers and Russell Westbrook. Steve, I will pause here to say it is December 1st. So this is time for your scheduled Lakers segment.
What a loophole.
Hey, you said once a month and we at the top of the month. I don't know what to tell you. While they have put together a great stretch of games due to AD being a tear in the paint, their guard play, and also the strength of schedule, I still have my questions. I am unsure if they are willing to part with Russ. To paraphrase Steve, teams are still trying to figure out the recipe for their meals. If Indiana seems to like what they see with the rumored pieces, do you think that the Lakers would be better off parting with Kendrick Nunn, Damian Jones to replenish their wing room? While the shooting has progressed to not all-time bad, as Nekias mentioned, I do wonder about the Lakers' holes on the wings, in particular having a big wing outside of LeBron who can shoot the three to help create space due to AD's dominance, as aforementioned. Do you guys see a fixable move or moves to help them have a blueprint to compete for a top six seed?
That's a tough question. I don't know if there's just one specific thing that's going to fix the totality of this roster. Just because the way it's constructed, you have to hit on the margins. And so I don't know if you can consolidate because you chose these players. Some of them were available late. Like, you got them for a reason. They have an opportunity. It's not that they can't play. But I don't know how many teams are out there saying, hey, I want those pieces, considering how tight the league is right now. So I don't know if there's a move out there to necessarily change it. You would probably love to have more shooting based on what you have. But I mean, conceptually, on paper at least, you have what you think could work, if that makes sense. Even if it's not. So how do you elevate that into something else? You know, what are you bringing to the table to make someone want to say, yeah, let's do that trade? That makes sense?
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. And, like, I think it's two parts, right? Because, like, one, should the Lakers consolidate and add to their wing room? Absolutely, unequivocally, 100% yes. They absolutely should. Who wants Kendrick Nunn and Damian Jones? And who has a wing that they would be willing to give up for those two players in particular? Which stinks because, like, for Damian Jones in particular, I was very excited about that signing. I thought he was going to be very good for this Laker team. And that just, it just hasn't played out that way. So is there a team with like a backup big that isn't performing well, or a lack of a backup big, and enough holes in the guard room to where we can take the flyer on, hey, maybe the pull-up jumper returns for Kendrick Nunn? I'm sure that that team exists. Like, I just don't know who that is right now. But as for like the heart of the question, do they have a fixable move? It's just, I think it's really tough to do without it being Russ. And it does help that Russ has taken the sixth man role in stride with an asterisk, and he's looked good there. And I think that gives teams the film of like, okay, this could work if he buys in. And then it just becomes an internal evaluation like, okay, do we have the roster to maximize him? And do we have the situation to where he feels comfortable buying in? And if so, then it may not be the Pacers deal where you get Buddy Hield and Miles Turner, especially with Miles Turner playing like this. But could that be elsewhere? Could that be Charlotte? Could that be insert team here? Like, maybe. Like, I just don't know what the consolidation move is if it isn't Russ. Because the other pieces are going to be guys with lower trade value somehow, or guys that you just don't want to give up. Like, I'm sure they could attach Austin Reeves to Damian Jones. The Lakers are absolutely not trading Austin Reeves with how well he's played this season. You could do like Nunn and Lonnie Walker. They're not trading Lonnie Walker if they don't have to, with the way that the shooting is bounced up and the way that he's coming off of screens and getting downhill. They're not doing that. And also, like, that hurts the wing room if you trade either one of those guys. So it just they are in a tough spot. Like, I don't know what the do you call Phoenix and be like, hey, what do y'all want for Jay Crowder? Like, even then, like, I don't know what that move is.
How quick of a conversation is that?
Probably 45 seconds. We have Patrick Bev. Hello, 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 Bueller. I don't know where you go with that. But okay, we can move to Steven. This is a fun one. Based off of last season and the early portion of this season, rank these drop coverage bigs: Brooke Lopez, Al Horford, Rudy Gobert, Joel Embiid, and Jared Allen.
I am going to go with Embiid 5.
Okay.
Just in the drop. I don't love the activity. I'm going to go Gobert 4. Al Horford 4. Jared Allen 3, Rudy 2, Brooke Lopez 1.
Okay. See, the based off last season plus early portion of this season is what really throws the list off for me. Because if it was just this year, like, this is a very easy list for me to make. Factoring in last year too, like, I think you still have to have Rudy 1 for factoring in last year too. Because Brooke Lopez played 18 minutes in the regular season last year. Like, it just kind of, like, that's not his fault. But, like, I think if you're counting last year, too, like, Rudy has to be 1. And from there, it gets fun. I would probably say, geez, man, Rudy 1, Jared Allen 2, Brooke Lopez 3, Horford 4, Embiid 5. I think that's where I go. Factoring in both the seasons, like, this is a really good question. I love getting deep into weeds with stuff like this.
It's a really specific one that you can't really slander Rudy on. It's specifically drop coverage.
You just said interior defense, it changes for you.
I mean, if there's a lot of different categories or sliders we could have added to this that may have changed the math, but that's the one I can't go that far.
Like, even I won't say he ain't.
That's his thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the thing indeed. All right. Second question from Steven. Both players in their prime and against any era, who would be your dream drop coverage tandem? Not the best you can think of, but your personal dream drop tandem and why? Must be one guard and one big or one big adjacent. The names that he mentioned was Pete Chris Paul and Pete Kevin Garnett, which good luck trying to score and drop against those two. But Steve, what would be your dream drop pairing?
It was tough because I was thinking the errors thing threw me off. I would love to see Marcus Smart bother and pester people and navigate screens. Davion Mitchell would also be fun if he's just turbocharged. Pete Kawhi would be fun. The drop part makes it interesting though, because it's like, okay, some of these errors that would just be fine. So I landed on, I want to see peak charged up Tony Allen and peak Marc Gasol in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Just torturing people.
Are they allowed to do that?
That's what I want to see.
Oh, God.
I just want to see the chaos they would cause.
Oh, nah.
Come on, Bob.
Oh, but yeah, Bob Cousy trying to run pick and roll against Marcus Smart. He's only going one way. Oh, man. Try that fancily dribbling if you want to. We're not going to slander them. Okay. Anyway. visual is absolutely killing me. Right?
I want to see Tibbs dominate the league back in the day by keeping everything on the left side of the court.
Why aren't y'all getting in the paint? They won't let us, coach.
Ice would have a whole new definition.
You know Tommy John can only dribble with his right. It's a steal every time. Oh my goodness. Like I saw, as I got the email, I saw the question. I was like, ooh, I would love to see Pete Chris Paul. And then I saw that Chris Paul was in the example given. I was like, well, okay, I'm not going to do that then.
Yes.
Not going to be fun. I would like the skill set mesh and also just the personality clash of Marcus Smart and Tim Duncan operating in drop. I think that would be a lot of fun. Like Marcus Smart just isn't letting you do anything. And then Tim Duncan, the fact that he does not have a Defensive Player of the Year award to his name and Marcus Camby does bothers the heck out of me. I'm sure he's a fine fella. I don't want to slander. But like also, dog. Anyway. Tim Duncan, his understanding of angles, the length, the timing, the shot blocking. And if this is peak Tim Duncan, like the mobility is going to be back. Like I just remember 38-year-old Tim Duncan in a drop and then also at the level sometimes at San Antonio, which is like, that's some fun film to go back through if you want to look at some old Spurs. But I'm watching Tim Duncan navigate a drop at almost 40. I'm just like, man, what did 24-year-old Tim Duncan look like? What would that look like? And you add in Marcus Smart or Drew Holiday for that matter, like either one of those two navigating screens with Tim Duncan on the back end, like you're just not doing anything.
It would be disgusting. Very quickly, just bouncing off of it, what's the opposite for you? What's the pick and roll duo you don't want to see?
Oh, geez.
And why does it involve Shaq and someone who can't get over a screen?
Oh Lord, I can't do this. I was about to make the joke like, well, Kendrick Nunn and Damian Jones. Like, I don't know if I want to see, but oh God, the duo that I don't want to see. I mean, like Shaq's gonna be fine in the drop. A lot of things when you ask him to do other stuff. Well, I mean, if we're talking about peak Shaq, then it just doesn't matter because that man can move.
Nah. Nah, give me Celtics Shaq is what I'm talking
about. No, dog, that was so sad. Man got hurt running up the court.
Change the subject. What's the next question?
All right, next. All right, we're going to cap this off with a question from Nate, which is a fun one. Also, very timely based on our conversation during the watch party last night. Sam Hauser had the reputation coming into this year as a if he can just be present on defense type of guy, but has shown so far to be a solid isolation defender, even when guys want to pick on him. Are there other players you've noticed this year that are playing above their previous reputations?
Sam Hauser, good example. The thing for him is just getting out of the liability zone. And he is trying, but teams are not cooperating. And it's like this duality of him having to do that to stay on the floor and Boston having so many defenders that when he's on the floor, it's just like, you come here. You are not any of these other people. You come here. And so he has to fight against that. And I think the problem is, I don't know if his solid is going to overcome that part of the equation where it's going to take him out of action. Like usually you can like defend your way out of the liability zone. Like Tyler Hero sometimes will do it where it's like, okay, we just won't attack that. He's doing all right today. Or Duncan Robinson might do it for like a stretch and they might just get out of that zone for a little bit. Boston's defense is so good. Sam's just going to have to deal with that all year. As far as other players I've noticed, probably the number one for me, it's Kyrie.
Okay.
That man is fighting for his life out there. It's not every single time, but the switches, he'll try. Who you got?
Okay. Well, if you want to start with the stars, then we can once again start with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Donovan Mitchell, De'Aaron Fox. Like, I think all three of those players have, I don't want to say defended above their heads because they have the capability of doing so, but based on what we've seen in years past, like, they have, all three have been much better than what we've seen in the past. The easy example for me last year was Max Strus kind of getting out of its own, and that has maintained this year, in my opinion. As far as other players go, I'll toss this out to you as a question. How have you felt about Luka's defense this year, staying on the star realm? But how have you felt about him defensively?
Better on ball than off. Okay. That's all I had. He's fighting on ball. it's very clearly like an initial burst. Like, nah, we're not doing this. But yeah. If you get past that push, you might get what you want. it's one of those, like, you know, when you get mad at someone before they get mad at you type deals.
Let's see.
I do want to tip the cap to Steph Curry, though.
Is he just the default answer because no one seems to not us, obviously, but like no one seems to understand how good he is at defense? I just hate how it just turned from, well, LeBron is picking on Steph, so clearly he's bad, instead of the Warriors have like four borderline all defensive players, and Steph is the only not non all defense type guy, and he's also the smallest guy on the court, so we're gonna pick him.
I think it's the fact that he always gets chosen, and some of the things are burned into people's brains, and you know he's always gonna get chosen, so it feels like it comes down to that, and if it doesn't work, it's like, see, I told you. I think it's more that type of deal.
Yeah, like that just doesn't seem fair. Like,
life isn't fair.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. Kristaps Porzingis is another one. The reputation portion makes this a little tricky, but Cam Reddish has been back for the most part defensively. Is there anyone else I want to throw a hat tip to? I mean, I don't know what your initial thoughts heading to the year of Nick Richards were, but like, he's been solid. You want to go deep in the weeds?
Do you have free throws?
That's a wild segue. Man said, "Nah, we're not doing this. I am saving you from yourself. You about to drop some pick and roll stats from Second Spectrum where Nick Richards is like 18th out of 111 guys and drop. And we're not doing it." No free throws for me today. Do you have free throws?
I do.
All right. What you got?
Is Mike Brown the coach of the year that won't get coach of the year?
He might be.
More determined to never let it happen again. Cam Reddish or Josh Green?
Josh Green for sure.
Okay. I need you to power rank these. I can do that. I promise you. Are you ready?
Okay. Yes.
Torrey Craig, I can be Jay Crowder.
We're off to a great start already. Okay. Torrey Craig.
Dante DiVincenzo, I can be Gary Payton II.
Okay.
Dean Wade, I can be Larry Markkinen.
Okay.
Reggie Jackson, I can be the scorer.
I already know who's number one on my list.
And Naz Reid, I'm that guy.
Okay. I love this question, by the way. Reggie Jackson is 1, 2, and 3. Let's start with Reggie Jackson's 1. Naz Reid, 2. Torrey Craig, 3. Dante DiVincenzo, 4. Dean Wade, 5.
Okay. Who has more belief in themselves, Dylan Brooks or Anthony Edwards?
Trick question. Klay Thompson. No. I think it's Dylan Brooks.
All right. Is praise for Devin Booker scoring 51 points in 31 minutes being met by Klay scoring 60 in 29 minutes, liking pancakes and waffles?
Yes. Yes, it is.
If so, what is French toast in that equation?
Oh, God. What is French toast? You know, Devin Booker scored 70 that one time. No, it was French toast, so it has to be Wilt. But
there we go. So French toast is Wilt. I see. More predictable, Marcus Morris jabbing Jay or Jaylen Brown attacking the basket with Jason Tatum needing 1 point to get to 50.
Oh, that's one of the most shameless experiences. And what makes that worse? They run some screening action to get Tyler Hero on Jason Tatum. This is among the players that are on the floor for Miami. This is literally the matchup for Jason Tatum to get a bucket or get fouled. And Jaylen Brown was like, oh, cool. A shot attempt. Brother. Understand the assignment.
Nah, man, group project. You know, three of us knew what time to beat the library. The other person didn't.
Y'all at the library working, Jalen emails, hey, yo, I got the outline here. Pardon? Brother, we already, okay. The answer is Marcus Morris.
Okay. Has Kawhi Leonard played basketball more with Jack Harlow than his teammates?
Oh, God. It's between this and the I need a man that don't play meme with the picture of Kawhi. It's like, yo, don't do this. Yes, I think Jack Harlow has gotten more passes from Kawhi at this point.
Why does Princess Kate clap on the ones and fives?
A better question. Why is Jason Tatum being asked to analyze that? Hey, I'm not going to go on a rant today, but like,
don't do it.
Come on, man. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Is it really a Good Morning America?
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NekaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun in there. Take part of the Dunker Spot watch parties. It's been insane. And that's probably the most accurate way that I can describe what these watch parties are. But get in there. And with that, take care of your loved ones. We will be back next week.
A whole marathon, huh?